when you ask how I've been here without you, I like to say I've been fine, and I do. But we both know the truth is hard to come by. And if I told the truth, that's not quite true. Some days a diamond, some days a stone, sometimes a heart. Sometimes a cold wind blows a chill in my bones. Some days a diamond, some days a stone.
Hey, welcome to Freebie Friday. Actually, it's the very first Freebie Friday of 2019. It's not the first Friday of 2019. Let me just be really specific and clear on that. It's the first Freebie Friday of 2019. I'm John St. Augustine. I'm delighted to have you with me in the new year. I already blew out the Wednesday rant a couple days ago, so I got a lot of that stuff off the top of my head. And I am thrilled to have this episode available for anybody who needs it, anybody that needs to listen to this, because the messages in here are so profound and humbling, actually, to me. And let me just put a little preface on what you're going to hear today and why I'm doing this show. First and foremost, when Jennifer Weigel recommends someone that I should talk to, I listen right out of the gate. I've known Jen a very long time, one of the great gal pals who I've shared a microphone with and some incredible conversation with. And one of the guests that I had on last year, Jennifer, got a lot of comments from people saying, you know, you guys should talk more often. Well, yeah, we're busy. We'll figure it out. But when Jen says, hey, you really should talk to this guy, I kind of pay attention. And that's the first part of this. The second part of this, once I read the book that you're going to hear about here in just a few minutes, I recalled all the times in my life that the unexplainable took place. And then I spent way too much trying to explain that which does not need explanation. And it all has to do with people who've passed away in my life. I've had some great and grand friends who have crossed over what I thought was before their time. And it turns out it probably was right on time, something that the human ego, especially mine, has a real hard time grappling with. So it's just this story that's coming up. I had the opportunity actually to sit down, which is always a thrill because a lot of the stuff I do solo where I'm pulling up clips, but to have someone come to the studio here in Chicago and spend time with me was just an incredible gift. And Joel McQuillan is going to be on deck here in just a couple minutes. We're going to be talking about his journey for the last 36 months and before that. But let me just put this disclaimer. This is past the preface part. I've had too many things that have taken place, too many experiences that I just left me with my jaw hanging open and my heart open. And I don't ever want those things to get in the way of remembering who I am, meaning sometimes life can go so muddled. You know, it's easy to get caught up in the politics. I see it all the time, part of being alive. But then something will come through and cut through all that stuff. And I don't know anybody who's battling cancer that gives a shit really one way or the other what's going on in politics, because all of a sudden your perspective shifts. And that's why I've always said, one of the reasons I have a difficult time spending too much time in politics that come to nothing is because I still haven't seen Democrat, Republican, or Independent on a headstone. I've seen son and daughter and father and mother and brother and sister and aunt and uncle and veteran, but I've never seen any political delineation on a headstone. So while I can dig into that stuff, I try to leave it at the end of the day where it belongs, which is in a bucket somewhere, because there's always more to dredge up. So because I've had these experiences that are unexplainable, sometimes are unavoidable, and sometimes they are nothing short of incredible, I thought it would be an opportunity to spend time with a guy who is a lot like me. We're cut from the same cloth, you know, blue-collar guys growing up and making your way in the world and doing everything you think is right and putting your nose to the grindstone. Sometimes just gets you a flat nose. And then something will come along and change all that, and you become, I think in some ways, I get this, almost a reluctant messenger. I had a time in my life where all I wanted to do was play football and coach. Nothing inherently wrong with that. That's why I have a hard time watching football on Sundays. But as these incidences that used to look like accidents, there's a difference between accident and incident. When I started to learn from them, I started heading in a different direction. My compass and my rudder was changed to a different port of call. And that's, I think, a little bit of what's happened with and through Joe McQuillan. And I want you to stick around after the conversation's over. There's a 3.5-minute song there at the end that kind of really pulls the whole thing together. It's called I'll Send You Feathers. And it was actually written by Joe and Brad Nye. And it's an amazing piece of work. So I kind of wrestled back and forth. Do I just put 30 seconds in? They own the song. They gave me clearance. It's all good to go. But as I listened to it 2 or 3 times, I thought the whole thing needs to be in there because somebody needs to hear it. You know, when I do the Wednesday rant and I'm banging away on politicians, what they're doing and not doing, it's really about human behavior and what we should expect and what we shouldn't from people. And this show is so far beyond that fodder that it's just nothing short of an honor to have this conversation. So in full disclosure, Joe McQuillan is sitting here in the vaunted Life 2.0 studios. We've already been talking for about 47 minutes. So usually when I warm up with a guest, it's not this intense. And I kept having to think we need to stop and hold that for the air, stop and hold that for the air. So first of all, thanks for driving from Winnetka all the way to Chicago. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
So listen, just to be really clear, you're a Buffalo guy.
Born and raised, youngest of 10 kids from Buffalo, New York.
Must be right. An Irish family.
Irish Catholic family, correct, absolutely.
Is it true that you actually, your family held up or changed your mom's funeral for kickoffs at the Bills game or something?
Well, we just had to move the time a little bit because there was a Bills game and we had to have a touch football game before the ceremony. So yeah, we had a family touch football game in Delaware Park. Then we buried my mom. Then we went to my brother's house and on time for the kickoff for the Bills game.
But your mom would have wanted that.
My mom didn't miss a Bills game. They were when they first got the new stadium. It was called Rich Stadium. Mm-hmm. Mom and dad were 300 level, but season ticket holders. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about growing up in Buffalo, New York. As I was reading, in the name of your book, which we'll get to in a few minutes, My Search for Christopher on the Other Side, will tell people why it's that title. But tell me about growing up in Buffalo. It seemed like this core sampling of a life that really doesn't exist anymore for a lot of people. You got this very hardworking, large Irish Catholic family that really came together no matter what. It's almost like a reality show to some degree.
It really was. You know, Sunday dinner at mom and dad's, just regular Sundays, not holidays, was mandatory. You know,
mandatory.
Showed up and the older brothers and sisters, like I said, I was the youngest of 10, so we were kind of in shifts growing up.
You were in shifts?
In shifts. My older brothers and sisters were 15 and 16 years older than I was. Mm. I stood up in their wedding. I was 5 years old when they were all getting married. Then the middle group and then us. Mm-hmm. And then the three of us, and I'm 62 today, and the three mm-hmm. of us were called the three babies.
Mm. You know? So and you're a baby at 62.
I'm a baby at 62, baby of the family. So it was always dinner at mom and dad's, always a Bills game, always a touch football game out in the street. Mm. And it was a pretty clannish existence, you know. Yeah. And we were kind of shanty Irish, so we never had to worry about the neighbors ratting us out because they didn't talk to us.
How did you end up in Chicago area?
You know what? I was living in D.C. for about 4 or 5 years with some family-connected job, and things were closing in a little bit on me. And I knew I could – I was working in unions at the time. I knew I had a couple connections that I could probably parlay here in Chicago, and chose not to do that. Got in the car business and had a great – great run there.
Car business as far as sales, manufacturing?
I started selling cars in 1985, became a manager, became a general manager, became partners with two dealerships.
Big time stuff.
You know what? It's just a job.
Right. But it's big time stuff to most people.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
And I had a great run. I had more fun than a barrel of monkeys.
You know, we probably at some point should do a show on all the things you should know about when you need to buy a car but don't know.
Oh, I'd love to do that.
I'm sure there's some secrets on the other side that you'd like to pass that along.
It's still fun. I still get the calls. My oldest pal, Alan, who is at least like a brother to me, his stepson was buying a car in Sarasota, Florida. And he said, you got to talk to Joe. And send him, I said, just put me on the phone with the manager. And we got it knocked out.
There you go. But then you got out of that about 10 years ago and started moving in a different direction.
Yeah, well, I was partners with Chuck Frank and Z Frank Chevrolet. Which was Z Frank. Yeah, yeah.
Legendary.
Wonderful family. And Chuck, I just adore Chuck and his wife, Deb. And in 08, when the whole banking blew up, you know, it put everybody in jeopardy in the car business. And Chuck came to me and said, we got to sell. You know, I didn't own any of the real estate. I was fortunate to be partners in the dealership. Sold out, and I had just had enough. We had had a combined 140 employees.
Wow.
And that's 140 headaches and tears. And so I was anxious to try something else. You know, when I was working 12 hours a day, which was most of my life, I would call my mortgage broker, and he'd be on a boat or skiing somewhere.
Right.
And I said, I'm going to try this. Now, the business has changed a whole lot.
Sure.
And those guys, most of those guys have all, you know, moved on because now it's hard to make a living. But, you know, if you got the work ethic that you have in the car business, you're going to be successful.
I was going to say, so some of what you did in the car business was able to get you going.
It's almost the same thing.
Sure.
Because it's
just
income,
a different product.
Ratios, credits.
Yeah.
I'm just attaching a lien to a house versus a, you know, a car.
Yeah. So you have all that going on, and you've been wonderful wife, Sally, 27 years.
Yeah.
Lucky guy, you.
I punted my coverage on that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you wrote in the book something about, you know, I'm probably the luckiest guy in the world.
Right.
That it kind of went out the way that it did.
She still takes my breath away. And as of right now, she's actually taking her test so she could do private practice. She's a therapist now, and helps a lot of people. And she's terrific. You know, I was in a closing last year with a friend of mine that I play hockey with, and the real estate agent went to college with Sal. And she looked at me and she said, how did you marry Sally Stearns? How did Sally Stearns marry you? I go, wow, that's kind of mean. And I looked at her and said, I made her laugh. And that's the truth.
There you go. And your sparkling personality.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, there you go. And the haircut, right?
The haircut.
The buzz cut.
Who doesn't like a guy with a broken nose and a buzz cut?
That's why we relate so much.
I like your haircut.
I appreciate that. So everything's kind of going along. You got your family's going good. Everything's coming along just fine. And all of a sudden, on January 3rd of 2016, all of your lives changed dramatically. What happened?
Well, you know, I have three kids. One's on the other side. And Christopher was home for college. And my little girl was at Marquette. And my youngest was in high school in his junior year. And Christopher and his buddies, all the new Truer kids, decided to go up to one of the friends had a lake house, and so they decided to just go up there and kick up their heels for the last weekend of the Christmas holiday. We'd had this amazing Christmas, and for some reason we just kept, you know, piling on and spoiling the kids. And I was taking days off from work, which I usually don't do, to go bowling or shoot pool with the kids. So it was just a phenomenal time. And so this was the last hurrah. They went up and they were shooting pool, and a dozen of them are just going to hang out and fall asleep at the guy's house and, you know, come back Sunday and watch the Bills game with me.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris was. As young kids will do, at 21 I'd have done the same thing. They walked outside past an unlocked boathouse, you know, that the family owned, and there was canoes, and they jumped in a partially icy lake and went out, and there were four of them, and none of them came back.
Yeah.
So I got a call. I was just getting ready to watch the Bills game, and I got a call that said, Mr. McQuillan, you know, Chris is missing. We can't find him and three of the friends. Grabbed my Labrador, jumped in the Jeep, and put on some boots and headed up. And halfway up, I got the call that it was no longer a search but a recovery because all four had crossed over, had passed.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a jillion questions, which all lead to the next thing. And I know that in short order, you had to get arrangements put together, and you had to step up and step out of your pain in order just to function to get this done. I can't even imagine. I mean, how did you find the resources in yourself, first of all, to put that pain aside for the moment and rise up? Have you ever thought about how you did that?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One is my pal, Michael, who was Christopher's godfather, my best man, best pal, was just never leaving me on that side. And so he helped gently guide me in the directions that I needed to, including, you know, burials. And his body had to be brought back from Wisconsin, and they couldn't release it for a day because it was an accident, and they had to do an autopsy and such. I didn't even identify the body. They wouldn't let me. And I had to restrain myself because I was not happy that I couldn't see my boy. But they showed a picture, and it was him and not him. He, you know, the spirit was gone. But you know, then we had, you know, wakes and in the church, and then a reception, and then a burial. And so it really was like sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
But I had these things that nobody else could do. It was my job to do, and I still had to do it. So, you know, you just rally and you do it.
And then, of course, comes the inevitable drop-off. That all ends. People have to go back to their jobs, and the well-wishers go back home, and the friends and family go back to their own lives, and all of a sudden there's this gap and that gulf in there. Do you recall when you knew that this was, that it all really had happened, that it wasn't a dream? Was there a moment or two that you thought, ah, shit, this is really the deal?
It was actually just the opposite.
Really?
Was that I knew that it was real, and I would wake up in the morning and forget that it happened.
Wow, that's interesting.
And then it would the grief would reintroduce itself.
So it was backwards for than most people. Backwards. Interesting.
You know, I knew this happened. This pain was like a cloud around my neck or on my head. But I'd wake up, and I think it's akin to maybe an amputee waking up in the morning, forgetting that they've lost a limb. And then you realize that, damn, this really did happen. And then you have to rally and try to get on with your life.
I remember seeing it on the news here in Chicago
yeah.
a couple of years ago. It was all over the news and very sad. And in some respects, I never thought I'd be sitting down with one of the boys' father, quite frankly, to have this conversation. And I wonder about the other parents and the other families that are involved in this. Have you stayed in touch with them at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I never thought I'd be here either, Chad.
Yeah, I suppose. I wish we were talking about hockey instead.
Yeah, I wish you and I met at a Bears game instead.
Sure.
Or a golf outing. But, you know, there were three other parents, and Nutria is huge.
Yeah.
You know, there's like 2,000 kids in classes. So I was close with one of the other lads that left with Chris Patrick. And the other boys, I knew their names, but I didn't know who they were. So I saw the parents up there, but we haven't connected. I guess it just didn't feel appropriate to connect in grief. The one lad that was closer friends with Chris, you know, I my heart broke because, you know, they didn't recover that young lad for three more days.
Oh, boy.
And it was horrible, and the pain that family's been through. So we've touched base, and they've done a couple of things. I know they built a gym, but that's a playground, but that's their story.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been any real contact.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they were supposed to, it would have.
Right. So you have this one life you grew up with.
Right.
Very idyllic Irish Catholic kind of thing going on.
Right.
And then you move into the middle part of your life where you were successful in business and you'd done your things and ran around and, you know, made a difference and sold cars and all this other stuff. And now you come into this part of your life and dealing with things you never thought you'd have to deal with. Has any of how you grew up helped you through this?
Well, sure. And you're right. I mean, what happens is you go through this and you check the box, like this is done.
Yeah.
And then if you got kids, whether one's crossed over or not, you find out that half the time you uncheck the box and start all over again with, you know, just as soon as you think something's finished, you know. So I think one is just the support. One thing about growing up in an Irish Catholic family is you really don't care what anybody else thinks.
Yeah, I had Irish neighbors.
Yeah.
They didn't give a shit about anything I was doing.
That's, you know,
and they were great for it.
And you know what? That's exactly it. So I've been asked before, you know, are you concerned what other people think about the subject? And I laugh and say, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. You know, I don't care what anybody thinks. Now, the truth of the matter is I changed with the writing of this book and with the event of Chris, because if you've lost somebody, I care very much what you think.
Yeah.
And I would love for you to buy in. I'm not trying to sell you anything.
Mm-hmm.
But all I want you to know is they're not gone. You know, they're still here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people ask me, my grandmother or my mom has been dead for 5 years and I haven't heard from her. And my thought is you're just not trying hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
You got to do some of the work, man.
The book is titled My Search for Christopher on the Other Side, which leads us to not how you grew up or Buffalo Bills or any of that stuff, which is fine, but that's this level of existence. The book is about this actual search and the connections that you've made. And I don't want to say since he's been gone, but since he's kind of transferred to a different wavelength. So what was the first time you knew there was something going on that was outside of this realm?
Well, you know what? I think I've always suspected. I'm 33 years sober.
Mm-hmm.
So that's allowed me to have a spiritual contact, you know, because I believe that God guided me through and helped me get sober. I think you get one bite at the apple. You get one shot.
Good way to put it.
You know, yeah. And so, you know, I was given this opportunity, and not everybody is, and I rallied. So I believed in the existence of God. But I believe in the Postmaster General, and I didn't have a whole lot of contact with him either. And that's kind of where we were.
Understood. Yeah.
So I got to tell you, one of the early things was I get on my knees every night and thank God for my sobriety. I thank God for my family, for health. So I'd do the same thing. I'd get on my knees, and I would say after Christopher, the days after he drowned, I'd get on my knees, and I'd thank God for those things. But I would say to him, but I'm still pissed that you took my kid. And I did this 3 days in a row or so. And I laid down after maybe the third day. And I got a clear as a bell, a message that said, I didn't take your son. And it was loving. It wasn't a reprimand. His recklessness and free will caused him to come home early. And I welcomed your son. But I didn't take him. And remember, I lost a son too. Mm. So it was at that point that I really believed that not only did he not pluck him from my family, that he was the one who carried me and kept me up when I was making all those arrangements.
How does that in direct opposition to the faith that you grew up with?
Well,
or is it?
Yeah, I don't think it's a direct opposition. I think the faith I grew up with was you know, in the 70s. I went to Catholic school for 13 years. The last year didn't work out real well for private Catholic college freshman. But the rest of them were great. I would say the prayer of St. Francis every day for 3 years. Mm. But it was like saying the Pledge of Allegiance. It didn't have an impact that I really thought of.
It didn't apply.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet now if you look at this, read the prayer of St. Francis, it can almost be a mantra.
Sure.
Every line, every day. So I think that kindness and love was always there. I don't think it was always in the hierarchy of the church.
Right.
But I think the teachings of, you know, the Christ that I believed in, you know, God's favorite son, rather consistent with how I feel right now.
So it kind of went from a theory to a real-world application for you.
Right.
So
right.
It's one thing to go to 13 years to class in school.
Right.
But it's another thing to have to dredge it up in yourself when you lose your son.
Well, 12 years of school, because the 13th...
You don't count the 13th at all?
I don't. They don't. I would.
Oh, they don't either?
I was willing to count it. They weren't willing to.
All right, I retract actually, that. 12 yeah, years.
12 years of a yeah, fine yeah. Catholic education.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of those 12 years prepared me, gave me some kind of foundation for something that I would use later.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happened.
And were you able to observe that? Like, you know, I kind of know why I have this in me now when it was most difficult?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. And I think it was just, I think there was always a kind, loving, I was raised by this loving father.
Mm-hmm.
Iron Joe.
Iron Joe, I read about him. Yeah.
40 years on the railroad. But he never left a conversation without saying, I love you.
Yeah.
And he never did a toast that he finished without breaking up. And he was tough as hardest, you know, tough man and a wonderful guy. But I had this loving father. So I think it's easier for a guy like me who has a loving father to acknowledge a loving heavenly father
mm-hmm.
than maybe a guy whose dad wasn't so loving or a little more distant, right?
Right, right?
So my dad was far from a perfect man. He was a flawed guy. But I knew that he had my best interest at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And he would never do anything intentionally to hurt me. And so I carried that over to my image of the next father.
Makes sense. So it's one thing to get to be kind of admonishing the Almighty for your son's death and then get a response. That's one level. But then you started to seek out mediums. How did that happen?
Well, I sought them out. And I think that's how this deal works, John. I really do. I think there's a great book that came out a number of years ago and kind of like a woman's movement, you know, The Secret, right?
Oh, sure.
But I loved it. And I downloaded it. I'd listen to it, books on CD or you know, download in the car. And the message I kept getting from that was that you got to go first with the universe. You got to start the ball rolling. And I think even, and you're not going to hear me quote scripture very often, but, you know, I think it's Matthew that says, all it takes is a mustard seed of faith. Mm-hmm. Well, I got sober in Chicago at a place called the Mustard Seed because all it takes is a mustard seed of faith.
Yeah.
So I think if you start the ball rolling, it'll pick up momentum. And I think that's what happened. You know, so I believe there was a God. I believe there was a higher power, you know. And so when Christopher was gone, I couldn't imagine a world that was completely void of him.
Mm.
And so I decided to try to find out if there's something there. And if it's real, let's pursue it. And if it's not, let's check it off and find something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had, years before, had gone seen a medium, and I think it was just part of a spiritual quest, I don't know, you know, and or a lark. Mm-hmm. And most of the reading was kind of mundane, mm-hmm. and I was getting a little antsy, as us ADD guys tend to do. And then she said, "Your dad's here." And I perked up a little bit.
Iron Joe.
Huh. Iron Joe left us in 88, or crossed. She said, "Your dad's here, and he's holding a caboose and telling me railroad," that you'd know what that meant. Hmm. Now, we were a railroad family. You know, I really believe everybody's family has a culture, mm-hmm. and ours was a railroad family. I've got a Canadian Pacific Railroad lantern in my office. Mm. All five of us boys worked on the railroad during school. All five of us, we were railroad family, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, the symbol outside of our lantern, a gas lantern, mm-hmm. growing up, that my brother has, you know, there was a railroad car. So when she said this, I paid attention, and in typical fashion, the old man didn't say anything else. He just wanted me to know he was there. Mm. But he showed himself subsequently a number of times, just to guide me.
I've always thought that the spiritual. Listen, here's how I see it. You know, we're all born into this game that we play called life, and that over time, we come in with full eyes, everything open, and over time, everything gets closed.
Yeah.
And the painstaking process of reawakening is difficult, challenging, and painful because we're so closed down after a certain amount of time. So it takes things like this to shake us up and wake us up. And they're difficult and challenging, and they suck. And yet, there seems to be such a ripple effect from these things that without them, it wouldn't be what it should be.
It's a movement.
It is a movement.
It's a, you know, and it's, I didn't choose this path. This isn't something I thought I'd be talking to you about a book I wrote. I never intended to be an author. I never intended to have my firstborn cross over.
Yeah.
But something happened after that, and I was pushed by spirit. And I think his energy, his spirit pushed me to write this book and talk to people and maybe heal a few hearts that think their kids are gone, mm-hmm. and that there's no access to them. And that's it. There's mm-hmm. void. It's darkness. Mm-hmm. Where I believe, seriously, it's like stepping from one room to another. And we've got to learn the rules to raise our consciousness and our energy level, and that they can lower theirs so we can connect in the middle, whether it's through signs or through mediums mm-hmm. or through meditation. That, you know, this stuff's real. You know, this isn't, you know, smoke and mirrors, folks.
One of the things, and we'll continue on with that, but the question pops in my head because as a hard-driven sales Irish guy who likes the Buffalo Bills on Sunday, to make the shift to sit here and talk about this as much as that was real to you then, this is as real to you now, do you think most people have these wake-up calls coming to them? Do you just ignore them?
You know, I don't know. I think it has to be something substantial to wake you up, to shake your reality.
So let me ask you a question. What woke you up to becoming sober? Because that's a serious, 33 years is a serious long time.
Yeah, right. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, I remember, today's my birthday, as I said.
Yeah,
I remember
62.
I remember my 25th birthday, and I was supposed to go to my sister's house for dinner. And I sat in a bar in Georgetown and thought, this isn't cute anymore.
At 25.
Right? Yeah, where I was, you know, the party boy, the fun, you know, now the party's here, now we can have a good time. You know, well, that was kind of cute at 19, 20, 21. It isn't so cute at 25, you know. So it took me a few years after that to finally get sober, but I think it was just the reality of, you know, I was wasting my life.
Sure.
And there had to be something better. And like the whole thought of the medium, you know, I can try this, and if it doesn't work, I can always go back to being the party boy.
That's right.
Right? And
that's
so it was the same thing where, you know, hey, take a shot.
Just an option.
Right.
Just
and
an
so,
option.
You know, I think God threw me a grapefruit that I was able to put over right field, you know?
So you have this experience, and Iron Joe shows up, and here's the picture, and here's what you need to do. That, in my experience, has been, too, it's like a shower curtain. You pull the first one, the rest are coming. Whether you take them or
that's
not.
That's a great point.
That's a different deal. So you the more starts coming, you start getting deeper and deeper and engaged in this, which seems to be, I don't know if you were as comfortable back then as you are now with it. Was it a gradual thing you got comfortable with these messages that were coming through?
Well, first of all, I had to make sure that this wasn't me fooling myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get comfortable with that. You know,
hearing what you wanted to hear.
Right. Am I doing this just to put a Band-Aid over my grief?
Right.
You know? So I had to deal with, you know, figuring this out. And the more it happened, and the content of what was being told by Christopher, from Christopher to me, narrated to me, proved the reality of this. In other words, he said to me, the very first time we did this, which was the anniversary of his crossing in January 3rd, 2017, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he told me, you know, I picked up a pen and started writing. And it was, you know, I don't know why, but I started getting these messages from him. And he said, it's like blue and green. It's like a beach. It's always warm. It's phenomenal. He said, it's friggin' amazing, Dad. You're not going to believe this. And all of this was well and good. Then he said to me, you got to be nicer to Scotty. It wasn't his fault. I loved him and he loved me. Now, Scotty was the young man whose parents owned the lake house. It wasn't his fault. It could have been anybody's house.
Mm-hmm.
But being Irish, you like to hold on to grudges.
Yeah,
right?
What's the Irish saying about grudges?
The Irish Alzheimer's is where you forget everything but the grudges, you know.
That's right.
Yeah. And so you know, I was, you know, forgive and remember. But I wrote this down. Now, that didn't come from me.
Mm-hmm.
That's contrary to how I was feeling. Somebody, sure. I need to blame somebody. And so it was when somebody's kids got a, you know, house on the beach,
and that's the human thing to do,
right. I, you know, couldn't be mad at God, so
right.
And so I said, sure, Chris, I'm fine. And besides, when will I ever need to confront this ever? You know,
mm-hmm.
Well, 12 hours later, I'm at the grave, and here's the young man who was very close to my son and a mm-hmm. lovely kid, and he came up to me and tears in his eyes and embraced me and hugged me and. I said, thanks, Chris, for preparing me for this. And I was really grateful. So that message didn't generate for me. Another time he told me, he was describing something, and he said, it's kind of like a canoe cutting through water. And I was like, wait, I'd never use that analogy, John. I would never use a canoe analogy.
Yeah.
My son was in a canoe when he crossed over. Mm. So those are the things that came to me and were explained to me by mediums. They're not from you. That's not your style. That, you wouldn't have said that.
Yeah. There's like a download is what it is. It comes from a different place. You mentioned a guy like you with ADD, but I remember reading in the book that one of the mediums kind of gave a different definition of ADD.
That was brilliant. And that was the I had seen a medium on a lark years and years and years before. And she told my sister and I some pretty crazy stuff, and it was pretty stunning, and it's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But then I saw this other medium when Chris was about five, and this was the woman who had brought my dad through, and she had said, "Your son Chris, they're going to tell you he's diagnosed with ADD, but she said, you know, don't listen to him. That just means he answers to a different dimension." And she mentioned he was an indigo child, which I had no idea what that was either. But he certainly proved
answers to a different dimension.
And he answered to a different dimension all his life, and he still does.
This, I don't want to call it automatic writing, but this is more like this download writing that you've had with your son, Chris. Has that increased, decreased? You never know what's going to happen. Does it always happen at the same time? How does that experience for you?
It's a wonderful experience, and it was, you know, it was your friend Osborne here. Right?
George Anderson.
Or George Anderson. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're thinking of Ozzy
George,
Osborne.
Yeah. No. But here, this guy, Osborne, wrote a book, was an investigator. But George Anderson's amazing. But I was three quarters of the way through this book, and I was calling what I was doing automatic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was reading another book about what automatic writing is, and it's like, oops.
That's different, yeah.
It's oops. This is called channel writing or spirit writing, you know. And basically what happens is, it's always between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
I get woken up, and if I look at my clock and it's 2:45, I know it's probably something on the other side, my son calling. So I'll go into the office, I'll light some sage, California white sage. I light a candle, I'll line my chakras, I'll have pictures of Chris around. And the reason I do all these things the same way is, you know, you're an old jock, right?
Yeah,
if it works, you don't change the
process,
right?
Never change your socks if you're
never
winning.
Never change your socks. I went through a whole season without washing my pants when we were almost undefeated as a baseball team.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, I did all that, and then I would pick up, and I would just start, I'd feel a chill on the back of my neck. I know he was there.
Mm.
And I'd listen to meditation music, and then I'd start writing. And then I'd write until he said, oh, you know, heading back, Dad. Got to go. Love you. Or whatever the ending was. And mm-hmm. that was the end of it. And the process then was, I'd then sit there for a second, grateful for the communication. I'd get a fine point pen as opposed to the broad pen that I'd been mm-hmm. trying. And I would go through my handwriting to make sure the next day I'd be able to read it and sure. decipher it.
Sure.
I'd make those changes. I'd staple it, put the date on it, put it in a file, and get on with my day. Either go back to bed for an hour or go start working at mm-hmm. 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And that happens 3 or 4 times a month to this day.
Mm.
You know, came to me on his anniversary. I think he was trying to come to me today, and I was just too distracted to be able to
sure.
pull it off.
Well, it's all about whether you're able to tune into things or not, or you know, and this is a very distracting world we live in. So,
right.
so that
right.
most of the writing, a little bit different than yours, but most of my writing time is 3 to 6 a.m. That's what's quiet, and the brain isn't awake yet and getting in the way. The reason I built up to this point, and I mean, if you'd have told me, I don't think I ever would have heard a Buffalo Bills fan say, I'm aligning my chakras.
I know. Please,
But the reason we kind of did this build up to this point is because I am totally convinced from the experiences that I had, and I'm a knuckle dragger just as you are, and a lot of people, friends of mine, that we're always having these wake-up calls. We ignore them. When we ignore them, they get louder until we can't ignore them. And then we are begged to pay attention, which we could have paid attention years ago, and we don't, but that's part of our development. And I could have, and I've had talked to people who are the George Andersons of the world and some of the rest of these folks. I don't question their abilities one way or the other, but I'm more connected with someone who, for a majority of their life, has lived as we all live. We right. work, we raise a family, we pay our taxes, we go on vacation, we bust our ass, and then all of a sudden something happens and a different frequency opens up. That, to me, is more connecting
right.
to things and more validating than just going to sit down and talk with someone who has a gift, because I think we all have it, we're just not using it.
You know, and I think that's exactly right. I think guys like you and I are solidly vested in this world. You know, we're solidly in this
yes.
this world until the events change for us to look behind the curtain
right.
and say, now what do you mean?
Right.
What do you mean? How do I do this?
Yeah.
How do I get there? And then we scramble to figure out the rules.
Yeah.
And we embrace it.
And
with
I believe
heart.
That scramble is part of our learning.
So do I.
It's how we grow.
Right.
Otherwise, we'd be back in the bar going, fourth down, are you shitting me?
Right.
With this channel writing, was that the basis? Did you know that it would become a book, or had that not
no,
been a
No, I had no idea. It's funny. What I expected was this channel writing was happening, and I didn't know. I thought it was the anniversary, and that was the one time.
And, mm-hmm. you know, and that would have been later, okay?
You know what? Whatever he gave me would have been a gift, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was grateful for it. And, you know, 10 days later, here we go. With the same thing. So I continued to do this and write it down, and then I'd put it in a file chronologically. What I assumed, John, was someday I'd be sitting on a rocking chair going through the file, reminiscing about the events and the visits I had with Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Never thought there was going to be a book. A year after I started the book, it was in February 2017, my brother-in-law was over with my wife, and they were downstairs talking about how tenacious Chris was when he'd play hide and seek when he was 2 and 3, and he'd say hide again, and he'd take off and hide and under a laundry basket or in a closet, and you'd find him and he'd say hide again and go hide somewhere else. And they were telling that story, and I just got compelled that the thought hide again caught in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I walked upstairs to my office, which used to be Christopher's bedroom,
mm.
and began to write and pulled out the files and started to write about the experiences. And so it was never an intention. At that point in time, I knew I was writing a book. And Sally mm-hmm. said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm writing a book.
And what was her response?
She had been writing a book on raising a challenging child who left early. And she said, you have no idea what you're in for.
That's right.
And I was, well, here's the crazy thing. So I was told as I got toward the end of this book, so I started writing it, and you know, I started collecting data right after Chris crossed over. Started writing it a year after he had gone, just over a year after he'd crossed. I was told to be finished, but this was toward the end, because I would get bogged down, I would get sad, I would get melancholy, and he'd say, come on, Dad, you got to get out of yourself. You got to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing with this book? Let's get going.
Mm.
And I would go see Medium, and the Medium would say to me, Chris says he really wants you to get going on that book. Well, I'm writing as fast as I can, right? So I was told to finish it before Father's Day of 2018, which I did. And I was 2 weeks ahead of time with the manuscript. Still needed editing and all that. And I sent it around, and I was disappointed because I, you know, and I didn't hear anything right away. And I sent it to this one woman, Lisa Hagen. And her name just came to me. You know, I was looking on the internet for people who were agents, and I'd met with a bunch of authors, and they said, yeah, I didn't have an agent. You got to have an agent who's in that field.
Right.
So I looked at Metaphysical and emailed her, and she emailed me back and said, I read a couple chapters. It was really intriguing. You're a very good writer, but I'm really busy. She gets 300 manuscripts a week.
Yeah.
She said, I'll finish it at the end of the summer, and I'll get back to you. A couple weeks later, she said, look, your son, you're tenacious, but he's just unforgiving.
So she was feeling it.
She said, your son's around me all the time. Every time I try to read another manuscript, he pushes me back to yours and his. Hmm. She finished it. She loved it. She sent a contract.
So as another guy who's, and I've done a fair amount of writing myself, I still write pretty much every day. When I write, I have to immerse myself in whatever that is, unless I'm writing somebody else's work. And even then I have to immerse myself. You're immersing yourself in the most painful event in your life, right, over and over and over again, over a period of time. And I had, my first thought was, that's like, you know, self-inflicted pain. So part of me, until we met, I'm reading the book going, so is this like Joe trying to process that which cannot be processed? There's no answer to this. And the other part was, how in the world, or were you able to, I don't want to say work through your grief. There's no such thing. You just come through it at different levels. So you're immersing yourself in this difficulty. There's no answers in here. It's got to hurt over and over again. When you finish writing the book, had any of that shifted for you?
Well, a couple things. I think what would hurt more than anything else, John, was not having my son with me. So I felt him with me every keystroke, every paragraph. He was involved in it. So I would sit down, and I will tell you, I keep a golf towel hanging over a railing of the rung of the desk. And every once in a while, I'd read something that would bring me back and take my knees out from under me, and I'd start crying in the towel. Yeah. And then it was like a tsunami that hits.
Mm-hmm.
And I let it go, you know, flow over me, and I let it happen. And then I get back to doing the job, which is writing. But I'm writing it with him with me. So the painful event is the loss, but now I'm experiencing the closeness. It's nowhere near the hug, the I love you, happy birthday, Dad, Merry Christmas, Dad. You know, it's nowhere near that, but it's the only game in town, and it beats the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So the real sadness would come if I wasn't feeling him, if there wasn't this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I've started a second book. You know, I didn't intend
to. Gee, I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know it. I really thought I had one book in me.
Yeah, apparently not.
And I think there's this path that I'm being pushed down.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is he's with me on every, you know, in every paragraph.
Mm. It also comes to mind that, you know, you're kind of, and I mentioned this to you before, especially in radio, I've done 25,000 radio shows everywhere from Oprah Radio to WGN to you name it. And I always felt I'm just the messenger. I'm just the postman. I just deliver the mail. Whether people read it or not, I have zero control over that. But if I don't do my part and I don't deliver the mail, then there's nothing for them to read. There's no other option. And we were talking before we started this about that concept. So you're like a reluctant postman as well. It's not what you wanted to be doing, but you have to deliver the mail.
I don't have a choice at this point. And if I chose, yes, I do. Everybody's got free will. And if I chose not to, I would lose that closeness that I so crave with my son. But it's so funny, the connection, the synchronicity with you and I, is that I was laying in bed the other day reading a text from a dear friend who said, I'm, you know, such a wonderful book. Congratulations. So proud of you. And I got literally clear as day a message from my boy to reply, I just carry the mail. And then when I sit down with you in the pre-interview and you say, you know,
I just deliver the mail.
You deliver the mail.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so that says to me, none of this is by accident. This is what's supposed to happen.
Absolutely. And even though I can only guess at what it must feel like to not have that physical part. My kids are both still around, and so I'm very blessed for that. And you have two kids that are still need you and Sally to be who you are. But it seems to be like this, and you mentioned here that this is kind of pushing reluctantly into a third career.
Right.
No surprise that the first two careers will probably make you more able to pull this one off.
Right, right. It is. You know, one of the benefits of being, you know, of working, selling, is that having a work ethic is that I can get up and work early in the morning like you and then go do my job.
Right.
And sometimes I'm in the middle of writing and I have an appointment where they're going to actually give me money,
right?
You know, as opposed to cost money,
right?
And I feel like I'm being pulled away. I hate that I have to go, but I have responsibility, and that comes from when you become a dad, you sign up for the deal, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, so I have responsibility on both sides. You know?
Right, right. And I have a coffee mug in my my other room, and it's from a friend of mine who wrote this great saying. He says it's very difficult to walk in two worlds with one spirit.
Right.
And I understand what you're talking about. I think most people have these little nuances and influences that come in our eyes when they lose someone. They're not really lost, but that's how we look at it. And it's very difficult to go back and forth and try to maintain one or the other. And so I'm thinking of that as we're having this conversation, but then I'm thinking of your family. So now you've beat your wife to the publishing table, is that correct?
Yes.
Well, at least he admitted it and publicly. And then I'm wondering, how do they all feel about you going in this direction? You're not the guy that you used to be to some degree. This has all shifted you. How do they play into all this?
It's great. And you know what? This morning, 2 o'clock this morning, my son walks in, brings the dog into my bedroom, and gives me a hug and says, "I'm really proud of you. Happy birthday."
Whoa.
And so, and once again, you know, I try not to put their story front and center.
Correct.
They're mentioned in the book.
Right.
I talk about them, but it's pretty obvious that their grief is their grief.
It's their journey.
They've had experiences from the other side too, whether it's a medium visit, whatever, but that's their story. Sally's had a number of herself, and that's her story.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think the reason this book got published, finished and published first, because it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's timely. The veil is thinning, and people need this right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sally's will be a follow-up to, you know, what the life was about, mm-hmm. when it's not about the metaphysical part. And she's a phenomenal writer and really very helpful with the editing process. She's brilliant.
One of the things I've always thought is that humans have the capacity to major in minor things. We come up with, we argue over very low-level things, and we forget our purpose, and we get distracted, and we get lost. The next thing you know, we're on our way out. We're going woulda, coulda, and shoulda. It seems to be, watching your journey a little bit, reading about it, that in some ways, let me ask you this. Let me put it this way.
Sure.
Have you ever felt that this has all been for your growth?
Oh, sure. Chris is evolving on the other side all by himself. I'm not helping him go to different levels. And there's some cool stuff.
And this
I've
has brought you to new levels, though.
But this has brought my soul to a different level.
Mm-hmm.
You got to understand, what I believe this holy is that we start out, there is no ability to reach somebody on the other side until we raise our energy level. Until, you know, I can't be lying, cheating, stealing, whoring, whatever,
right,
and expect to connect with my son on the other side.
Right.
Right. So I've got to raise my energy level, and that he can level it. You know, we're kind of psychic slugs, right?
Sure.
And so, so if I want to connect with him, I have to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's just an awareness of what the other side's about. And for me now, it's a quest of figuring out. There's a great term I just read, and a guy wrote a book, John Holland wrote a number of books, and this is the first time I've read it. And he talks about thin spots.
Hmm.
And those are the places on earth, you know, that are where the veil is very thin between both sides. I've experienced it in Sarasota, two beaches there.
Mm-hmm.
One having quartz crystal sand. I didn't know that. I just knew it was special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Sedona's that way. You know, so I'm
because
really
of the energy, because of the energy people carry in those areas and what they do and,
you know,
what they're focused on and what they're not.
I don't know why those are thin spots. I know that the one beach in Sarasota, it was from the Appalachian Mountains, and 2,000 years ago, it washed down quartz crystal. And that's so when these people have gone for Sarasota all their lives, and we were a blue-collar family, so we didn't go to Sarasota.
Yeah, I didn't go there.
And spring break. We didn't know what spring break was.
When I was at school at spring break, we go back and clean the school.
Right, right. Yeah, you could go to work for a bit
there
or whatever.
There you go.
And so we, And so we would, so you, but you could walk on the sand because it's quartz crystal and your feet wouldn't get hot.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about that till I was after writing the book.
Sure.
And my friend from Sarasota said, when the hurricane didn't hit, well, that's because, you know, Siesta Key is quartz crystal. The Indians consider it sacred. So
how
I think they're sacred spots.
How has this changed, if at all, your relationships with all the guys? With all the guys you know, they've watched you go through this. People that have known you most of your life, how have they reacted to all this?
That's a great question. And, you know, my support system is amazing. I've got this amazing bunch of guys. Guys that played in the NFL, guys that are musicians, guys that, you know, business guys, car guys. And a few of them had exposure. A lot of my friends are affiliated with AA.
Yeah.
So it's an exposure to God. And a few of them said to me, I wouldn't buy any of this if it didn't come from you.
There you go.
And so I think, without being too dramatic, that a guy like me might be chosen because I'm the least likely guy you'd think would carry this kind of psychic message.
Hence the reluctant postman.
The reluctant postman.
Yeah. Towards the end of the book, you make a very important distinction between the word belief and knowing.
Right.
Tell me about that.
I believed in heaven. I truly did. I didn't know what it was about. I didn't think it was harps and thrones, but I believed in heaven. And I believed in heaven up until this exposure to the other side. When I got this exposure to the other side and the connection with Chris and the undeniable, you know, miracles, I guess you'd say, that I've experienced. Was it Einstein says that you go through life either, you know, living life that everything's a miracle or nothing is?
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so these, you know, so these things that have been laid out in front of me. So at that point in time, I looked and said, I know this. I know this like that your desk is wood.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a knowing for me. There's another side. My son's there. And I got to tell you, I got work to do. I still got two kids here. I've got this book to get out. I'm going to do some other things. And I'm not ready to go. You know, I'm not ready to retire. I'm not ready to pass away. But if God touched me on the shoulder and said, Joe, today's the day. I'm okay. A, I lived a life beyond my wildest dreams. B, I get to be in heaven or the other side or whatever you want to call it, where I'm told it's like a beach house in Maui.
Not a bad gig.
As opposed to the boot camp.
Right.
Three-a-days, as Christopher actually described it, boot camp.
Right.
On this side. And I get to be with my son who's in the soul family, my soul family, because I've been told that too. So if it's time to go, you know, I'm good.
Mm,
you know, let's go. And I'm going to miss you, but it's time to go and see Chris.
I got two things. I'm trying to figure out which order to put these in, so I'm just going to go with the flow here. Going to give you the mic for as long as you need it. Anybody listening to the show who's lost a child or lost anybody, and that concept of loss is something that's more than they can possibly stand, what do you say to those folks?
Okay. First of all, they're not gone. You know, you got to go first. They're there. You can connect with them. It is unbearable. It's painful because it's never going to be the same. But there is access to them, you know. So reach out. Reach out to a guy like me. Go online. Find a medium. Get referrals from somebody. Go out on a limb. You know, it's worth the risk. It's worth the effort, you know. So I'm just telling you, try it. Try harder. It beats the alternative of thinking that the rest of your life is just darkness or the rest of their lives is just emptiness. Mm. And that's not true. So work hard at it.
One of the big things in life is that if you open the obits on any given day and your picture's not in there, somehow our ego, I'm convinced of this, thinks, well, everybody else dies but me. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the one thing I do think is that about this world that I'm learning more about, if you've been delving into a few years, we're all going. You know, that's the...
Can you repeat that?
We're all going.
We're all going.
Yeah. So I know when I'm going on vacation, I jump on the internet and I look up what it's like, how to get in and out, restaurants, beaches, whatever. I want to know as much as I can about where I'm going. So why in God's name, literally, why in God's name, wouldn't we want to know what's next? And the bottom line is, that's the knowing for me, that there is another side. There are rules. It's phenomenal. But you may as well get used to it, pal, because we're all going. And a couple things. Is my Chris lived 21 years on this side and had an amazing impact. We had 2,000 people at his wake. 2,000 people. You couldn't pay 2,000 people to come to my wake, John. 2,000 people at his wake. And you know, we have this gathering at his grave on the anniversary, and we had, you know, 30-some kids, people show up, you know, just for this gathering. And so he had done so much, and half the stuff I didn't know until his pals were telling him, you know, that he crammed into these 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is I got to be his dad for 21 years.
What an honor.
It was the job of a lifetime. I got to be Christopher's father on this side for 21 years. And I'm told I'll still be his father on the other side, which is even a better blessing, right? So, and as painful as the end result was, I'd make that deal 7 days a week, right? The love that I got, 21 years of being his dad was the privilege of a lifetime. And the aha moment is every day matters, right? That's the aha moment for me. That this moment you and I have,
yep.
And even more fun than this was the 45 minutes before. Just
nobody else heard but us.
That nobody else heard but you and me.
Yeah.
But the connections, the similarities, you know, that we'll never have that again.
Yeah.
Cherish that. Yep. Yeah. You know what? Go home, hug your dog, man. Kiss your kids. Embrace them. You know, whatever. Don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this is boot camp. You're supposed to make mistakes here. Right. This is the 3-a-day practices where we screw up, and then we get to take it on the other side where it's a bungalow on a beach. Man, sign me up.
Play a little Jimmy Buffett.
Play a lot of Jimmy Buffett.
The name of the book is called My Search for Christopher on the Other Side. Joel McQuillan wrote it about his son and his journey. Amazon everywhere.
Amazon.com. And if you like it, leave a review. And if you don't, keep it yourself.
Is there a website for all this, too?
There is. There's a website of www.joemcquillan.com or www.mysearchforchristopher.com. Upcoming events, Wilmette Theater's coming up, and check it out. My email's there. If there's anything I can do for you, give me a call, give me an email. I'm happy to talk to you.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Tears, I had to go. There is something that I want you to know. I'll be with you, I'll send you a sign. Always know I'll be there to remind you. We'll be together in heaven, in that sea. Send you feathers. My days were long, my nights were warm. You did your best to keep me safe from the storm. I felt your love, there was no doubt. How could you know that the sand will just run out? We'll be together in heaven, in that season. All the time we will treasure. Until then, I'll send you feathers. Time for sweet goodbyes. I see the pain in those soft Irish eyes. I'm trying hard to let you know I'll be here at the end of your road show. We'll be together in heaven, in that season. Treasure. Until then, send you feathers.